A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. So I mentioned before, I'm a huge fan of looking at these photos of control centers. From a number of years, I think, before I set up my first multi-monitor workstation, I loved looking at photos of these environments. People know about the NASA Space Center. It's a classic one. But you also have these amazing setups in places all over the world. The commonality is that these don't tend to be public-facing industries. And I think part of it is a genuine sense of admiration for the people who work in these environments. Everyone sees the bright lights of an ambulance when it's coming to get someone. But when you get through to 911, you're getting through to a dispatch center, and the person probably has a pretty cool multi-monitor display. So they're environments where people who do extremely important work are based, often unseen work. And not only that, not only do they often have these, you know, fantastic, and probably the best multi-monitor displays you'll see are in these type of environments, but they take ergonomics more seriously than any other industry. And that's not even accurate, because these type of environments are seen in different industries. Police departments have them. SOCs in enterprise tech will stand up these type of environments. Firefighters, law enforcement, intelligence. Dispatch centers, every time you're in the air, there's somebody sitting in a dispatch center, a dispatcher, watching your flight in an operations center that very few people even know exists. So these people do great work, and they need their screen arrays, but the companies that create these have gone even further and perfected ergonomics in a way that is very refreshing in today's world, where startups have gone in for open office layouts where it's often everyone just crouching over a laptop. So these guys do it exceptionally well. So I printed a photo book just to have as like a coffee table thing whenever I was kind of planning or moving into a new place and wanted to get some inspiration, literally a printed book. And I noticed that they had the push to talk buttons you'll see a lot of, because so much of this is voice driven, didn't look like they were connected with USB. I couldn't help but notice in all the photographs, they had what looked like a really kind of old school interface. And I'd like to talk today about that in the spirit of talking about weird and niche technical subjects. These, I believe, are actually indeed specific interfaces for what you could call military grade or professional grade headsets. We tend to assume that everything works on USB or if not on XLR. But there is an entire realm of other technology that uses totally different interfaces. Not only the headsets, also the push-to-talk buttons. And if you're so motivated, this would take quite a lot of motivation, but you could probably get a connector to one of those. I'd love to talk about what these connectors actually are, specifically the connection protocols, what's required to make them interoperable with USB HID, and what kind of price we're talking about. Is there any reason why an ordinary but dedicated consumer, maybe someone who is using voice tech through laptop constantly sending messages, might actually be able to get one of these rigged up to their computer in a way that's useful?
Daniel sent us this one, and I've got to say, it's the kind of prompt that makes you feel seen if you're the sort of person who pauses documentaries to study the background workstations. He's been collecting photos of control centers for years. NASA, police dispatch, air traffic, security operations centers, and notice something in the details. The push-to-talk buttons and headsets in these environments don't use USB. They've got these chunky, military-looking connectors. His question is, what are those connectors actually? What kind of protocol do they use? What would it take to make them work with standard USB at HID? And could an ordinary but motivated person rig one of these up for daily voice-driven computer use?
Oh, this is deeply, deeply my kind of rabbit hole, and the prompt is right on the money. These are almost certainly what's called the U174 connector, or its close cousin, the U283. They're part of a family of connectors standardized under something called the TP120 NATO specification.
TP120? Sounds like a tax form.
It's the NATO standard for audio connectors in military and professional communications gear. And it's one of those things where once you know what you're looking at, you'll see them everywhere. Every movie with a helicopter pilot, every photo of a SWAT team, every air traffic control tower, same chunky circular connector with that satisfying quarter turn lock.
The quarter turn lock is doing a lot of work here. You see it in photos and you can almost feel it.
And it's designed that way for a reason. These connectors have to survive being yanked, stepped on, exposed to jet fuel, rain, sand, extreme temperatures. A USB-C connector is rated for about 10,000 insertion cycles if you're lucky. A U-174 is rated for tens of thousands, and it'll keep working after being submerged in salt water. The spec is genuinely absurd.
This is the opposite of the open office laptop crouch. This is hardware designed for someone who might need to coordinate a rescue operation while things are actively on fire.
And the connector is just the physical layer. The audio standard that typically runs through these is something called four-wire electret with dynamic bias, which is a mouthful. But here's what matters. It's not just a different plug shape. It's a fundamentally different electrical design from consumer audio.
Break that down. What makes four-wire different from the 3.5mm jack I'd plug into a laptop?
A standard consumer headset uses three conductors, sometimes four if there's a microphone. It's unbalanced audio. The signal travels on one wire and the ground carries the return. That's fine for a 3-foot cable in a quiet room. The problem is, unbalanced audio acts like an antenna for electromagnetic interference. In a dispatch center or a military vehicle, you've got radios, radar, power lines. The noise floor is enormous.
Your push-to-talk transmission ends up with a background hum of whatever electronics are nearby.
In a consumer setting, that's a minor annoyance. In an air traffic control setting, that hum could obscure a critical altitude reading. So four-wire audio uses a balanced pair for the microphone and a separate balanced pair for the earpiece. Each signal has a positive and negative line, and the receiving end flips the negative and combines them. Any noise that got picked up equally on both lines gets canceled out.
Common mode rejection. Same principle as XLR.
But XLR is bulky and not sealed against the elements. The U-174 gives you balanced audio in a compact, ruggedized, environmentally sealed package. It's XLR's tougher, angrier cousin.
The connector that XLR doesn't make eye contact with at family gatherings.
Here's the thing about the push-to-talk buttons. In these environments, the PTT isn't a USB HEID device sending a key code. It's a physical switch that literally completes or breaks an electrical circuit in the audio path. It's hardware-level muting. No software involved. No operating system to crash. No driver to fail.
When you press that button, you are mechanically closing a circuit. It'll work even if the computer behind it has blue-screened.
That's the design philosophy, and it connects back to what the prompt noticed about ergonomics. These environments take ergonomics seriously, not because they're nice workplaces, but because a dispatcher might be in that chair for 12 hours during a crisis. Fatigue isn't just discomfort, it's a safety risk.
I've seen photos of those consoles, and the thing that always strikes me is the sit-stand desks that look like they could survive a car crash. The monitor arms are industrial. The chairs look like they were designed by orthopedic surgeons.
Companies like Evans Consoles and E119 are the names in this space, and they bill for what's called a 95th percentile operator, meaning the console has to accommodate everyone from the 5'1" dispatcher to the 6'4" dispatcher without anyone developing repetitive strain injury. The monitor positioning is calculated down to the degree of neck flexion.
Meanwhile, the startup down the road gave everyone a 13-inch laptop and a stool made of reclaimed pallet wood.
Called it radical collaboration. There's a genuine philosophical divide here. The consumer tech world has been on a 60-year trend toward miniaturization, wireless everything, touch surfaces, fewer buttons. The professional communications world went the opposite direction. They want big buttons you can find by feel in the dark. They want positive tactile feedback. They want cables that won't disconnect if someone rolls a chair over them.
The glockenspiel of corporate approachability versus the bass drum of mission-critical reliability.
That's actually a perfect way to put it. And it gets at why the prompt's question about interoperability is so interesting. These two worlds don't naturally talk to each other.
All right, so let's get practical. Someone sees one of these U174 headsets or PTT buttons, maybe surplus, maybe new, from a specialty supplier, and thinks, I want that on my desk. What's actually required?
Step one is understanding that you're not just adapting a plug shape. You need to convert balanced four-wire audio to unbalanced consumer audio, and you need to provide the correct bias voltage for the electric microphone. A U174 headset mic typically expects between 4 and 14 volts DC bias. Your laptop's headset jack provides about 2 to 3 volts.
Plugging it in with a passive adapter gives you a very quiet, sad microphone.
If it works at all. The impedance is also completely different. Military headsets are often 150 ohms or higher. Consumer earbuds are typically 32 ohms. So even if you get the physical connection right, your laptop's audio output might not be able to drive the headset speakers to a useful volume.
You need active electronics in the middle. Not just wires, but a powered interface.
And this is where it gets into territory that's fun if you're the kind of person who enjoys this stuff. There are commercial products that do this. Companies like David Clark and Bose make aviation headsets that include U174 connectors, and they sell adapter boxes that convert to consumer audio standards. But those are designed for their specific headsets, and they're priced for the aviation market.
Which is to say, add a zero.
Two zeros sometimes. A David Clark headset can run $600 to over $1,000. The adapter box is another couple hundred. And that's before you even get to the push-to-talk integration.
The commercial path exists, but it's priced for people who need it to fly planes, not for someone who wants a satisfying click when they dictate into their laptop.
The alternative is the DIY path, which is accessible if you're comfortable with a soldering iron and maybe an Arduino or Raspberry Pi Pico, and this is where I get excited because the components are surprisingly cheap.
Walk me through the signal chain.
You got your U174 headset. It's got a male or female connector depending on whether it's the headset side or the panel side. First thing you need is the mating connector, and here's where people get sticker shock. The connector alone can be $40 to $80 new from Amphenol or ITT Canon. These are precision machined parts with gold-plated contacts and environmental seals. But surplus is your friend. You can find them on the secondary market for $15 to $25.
Surplus military connectors. The most Herman shopping advice imaginable.
I contain multitudes. So you get the connector, you wire it to a breakout board. Now you need to handle the audio. A small USB audio interface, something like a Behringer U-Control or even one of those little Sabrent USB adapters, gives you stereo output and mono mic input. But here's the trick. Those expect unbalanced consumer-level signals.
You still need something between the military headset and the consumer audio interface.
You need a small preamp circuit for the microphone that can provide the correct bias voltage, and you need a headphone amplifier that can drive higher impedance headphones. Both of these are well understood circuits. You can build them on perf board for maybe $15 in components, or you can buy pre-built modules from companies like Adafruit or SparkFun.
The push-to-talk button?
This is the part that's elegant. A military PTT button is just a normally open momentary switch. When you press it, it closes a circuit. If you're going full DIY, you can wire that switch to a microcontroller, an Arduino Pro Micro or a Raspberry Pi Pico, and have it present itself to the computer as a USB HID keyboard or joystick button.
The computer sees it as key pressed, and whatever software you're using for dictation or push to talk can map that to its transmit function.
And the microcontroller boards that can do this cost about $10. The Pico has native USB-A itch ID support. It's literally a few lines of code.
The total bill of materials for a DIY setup, surplus connector, audio interface, preamp components, headphone amp, microcontroller, enclosure. What are we talking?
If you're scrappy and patient, you could do it for under $100. If you want new connectors and a nice enclosure, maybe $200 to $250. Compare that to $1,000+ for an aviation certified commercial solution.
That's reasonable. It's not impulse buy cheap, but it's dedicated hobbyist with a specific vision. Cheap.
That's exactly the persona the prompt is describing. Someone who uses voice tech constantly, wants the tactile satisfaction and reliability of professional gear, and is willing to put in some work.
There's something about this that goes beyond the practical, though. The prompt mentions printing a photo book of control centers. This isn't just about getting a thing that works. It's about the aesthetic and the ethos of these environments.
And I think there's a whole conversation here about what we're actually optimizing for when we set up a workspace. The consumer tech industry has been optimizing for portability, for sleekness, for making things disappear. The control center industry optimizes for presence, for things being exactly where you expect them every time without looking.
It's the difference between a glass touchscreen in a car and physical knobs. With the touchscreen, everything can change. With the knob, your hand knows where it is.
In a high-stakes environment, that's not a preference, it's a requirement. There's research on this. A study out of the University of Utah a few years back found that drivers using touchscreens took their eyes off the road for significantly longer than drivers using physical controls. The cognitive load is different. You're using visual processing to confirm that your finger is in the right place, whereas with a physical control, proprioception handles it.
Which is why a dispatcher's console has 100 physical buttons, and they know every one by touch. The ergonomics aren't just about preventing carpal tunnel. They're about reducing the mental overhead of interacting with the system.
This connects to something the prompt touched on that I think is worth digging into, the voice-driven nature of these environments. In a dispatch center or an air traffic control tower, voice is the primary modality. The screens are reference material. The actual work happens through speech.
Which is increasingly true for knowledge workers, too. If you're dictating messages, if you're using voice commands, if you're in and out of calls all day, you're doing dispatch-style work, just with different stakes.
Yet the hardware we use for that is still designed for the keyboard and mouse era. A laptop's built-in microphone array is fine for video calls in a quiet room, but it's doing a bunch of software processing to clean up the audio. There's latency. There's the occasional glitch. A professional headset with a noise-canceling boom mic and a hardware PTT gives you clean audio with essentially zero processing delay.
The prompt mentions noticing these push-to-talk buttons in the photographs and wondering about the interface. I get the appeal. There's something satisfying about a physical button that does one thing and does it reliably.
The satisfying click is not trivial. There's a whole field of human-computer interaction research around haptic feedback and user confidence. When you press a membrane keyboard key, you're not entirely sure it registered until you see the character appear on screen. When you press a military PTT switch, there is zero ambiguity.
It's the difference between sending a text and keying a radio. One has a vague, asynchronous confirmation. The other is immediate and physical.
That immediacy changes how you interact with the system. It becomes an extension of your intention rather than a request you're making of a device that may or may not respond correctly.
Let's say someone goes down this path. They source a U174 headset. They build or buy the interface box. They get the PTT button working as a USB HID device. What software are they actually using this with?
That's the beautiful part. Once the PTT presents as a standard HID button, it works with anything. You can map it to the push-to-talk function in Discord or TeamSpeak. You can use it as a dictation toggle in Dragon or whatever voice-to-text system you're running. If you're using something like VoiceAttack for voice commands, it can be the trigger. It's just a button as far as the computer is concerned.
The hard part is all in the physical and electrical conversion. Once you've done that, the software side is trivial.
And I want to circle back to something the prompt noticed about the connectors not looking like USB. There's actually a whole ecosystem of professional audio connectors beyond U174. The U283 is the same family but with more pins. It adds contacts for things like auxiliary audio channels or serial data. There's also the Nexus TP120 connector family from Amphenol, which is used in things like police motorcycle helmets and firefighter communications.
If you're browsing surplus listings and you see something labeled NATO headset connector, it could be one of several variants.
This is the part where I'd caution anyone going down this path. Do your pinout research before you buy. The U174 standard defines the connector body and the electrical characteristics, but different manufacturers and different military branches sometimes assign the pins differently. A U.S. Army headset might have the microphone on different pins than a Royal Air Force headset, even though they're using physically identical connectors.
You need the wiring diagram for the specific headset you've acquired.
Ideally, a multimeter to verify. It's not hard. There are only 4 to 6 pins in most of these, but it's the kind of detail that'll drive you crazy if you assume standardization that doesn't exist.
This feels like a good moment to zoom out. The prompt is asking about a very specific technical thing, connector types and interoperability. But underneath that is a bigger observation about how the tools we use shape how we work.
That's what I love about this. The prompt started with looking at photos of control centers and noticing something that most people would never see. And that observation leads to a whole alternate universe of hardware design philosophy.
The universe of things built for people who can't say, "Let me reboot and call you back."
And that philosophy produces objects that are different from consumer gear, not just in durability, but in the entire interaction model. A consumer product asks, "How do we make this small and pretty and wireless?" A professional communications product asks, "How do we make this work the first time, every time, for 20 years, in any conditions?"
The 20 years part is important. These things are built to be serviceable. You can replace the ear cushions, the cable, the microphone boom. They're designed for maintenance, not replacement.
Which is almost a political statement at this point. The consumer electronics industry has moved so far toward sealed, non-repairable devices that a headset with user-replaceable parts feels almost subversive.
Buy it for life, but with a military specification sheet.
There's something to be said for that approach even in non-critical applications. If you're someone who spends 8 hours a day on voice calls or dictating, the reliability and comfort of professional gear might improve your quality of life. Not because you're landing planes, but because friction adds up.
The death of 1,000 minor annoyances.
The Bluetooth headset that needs charging. The wireless connection that drops. The microphone that picks up your keyboard clatter. The button you're never quite sure you pressed. Each one is tiny, but across a workday, they accumulate into a background hum of frustration.
The professional gear approach is to eliminate each of those at the hardware level rather than patching around them in software.
There's a principle here that I think applies far beyond headsets. When you're building a system for critical work, you want to push reliability as close to the physical layer as possible. Software is flexible but fragile. Hardware is rigid but robust. The PTT button that physically breaks the audio circuit is the perfect example. It cannot fail in a way that software can fail, because there is no software.
It's the same reason I still prefer a physical switch for a light over a smart bulb. The smart bulb needs the network to be up, the hub to be responsive, the app to not have updated and broken itself. The switch needs physics.
The switch will outlive you. There are U174 connectors in service right now that were manufactured in the 1970s. They've been plugged and unplugged hundreds of thousands of times. They've been rained on, baked in desert sun, frozen in Arctic conditions. They still work.
The question of whether an ordinary consumer could get one of these working on their desk. The answer seems to be yes, with asterisks.
Yes, with interesting and satisfying asterisks. You need some electronics knowledge, or at least the willingness to learn. You need to be comfortable with a soldering iron. You need to do your research on the specific hardware you're buying. But none of this is black magic. It's all well-documented, well-understood analog electronics.
The result is something unique. A piece of hardware on your desk that was designed for a completely different world of use, adapted to your specific workflow.
There's an aesthetic dimension to this too, and I think it's worth naming. The prompt mentions printing a photo book of control centers as inspiration. There's a whole community of people who are drawn to the visual language of industrial and professional spaces. The clean lines, the purposeful design, the absence of decoration.
It's the antithesis of the move fast and break things aesthetic. Everything in a control center is there for a reason, and that reason is usually someone's life depends on this working.
That gravity is visible in the design. You can see it in the photos. The consoles don't look fun, they look serious. But there's a beauty in that seriousness.
The beauty of competence.
The beauty of things made by people who care deeply about getting it right. And I think that's what the prompt is really getting at. Not just a technical curiosity about connectors, but an appreciation for a whole tradition of design that prioritizes function so completely that it wraps back around to being aesthetically compelling.
It's the same reason people are fascinated by the Apollo guidance computer or old mainframes. These objects represent a kind of focused intention that feels rare in consumer technology.
The wild thing is, this stuff is still being made. It's not vintage. Companies like David Clark, Bose, Sennheiser's professional division, Plantronics' government division, they're actively manufacturing U174 headsets and accessories right now. The technology is alive and evolving.
Just invisible to most of us, because we're not the target market.
And that exclusivity is part of the appeal for the hobbyist. You're not supposed to have this on your desk. It's not sold at Best Buy. You have to know it exists, figure out how it works, and build the bridge yourself.
Like adopting a feral cat.
A feral cat that will outlive you and function perfectly in a sandstorm.
To bring this back to the practical question, if someone listening wants to do this, where do they start?
I'd say start with the headset. Find a surplus or used aviation or military headset with a U174 connector. The connector will usually be clearly visible in photos. It's the chunky circular one with either 4 or 6 pins. Brands to look for include David Clark, Telex, Bose A20, and Sennheiser's Professional line.
Expect to pay?
For a used David Clark, you're looking at $100 to $200, which is not nothing, but compare it to a high-end consumer headset and it's actually competitive. These things were $600 to $1,000 new, and they hold up incredibly well on the secondary market.
Because they're built like tanks.
Built like things that are expected to survive a helicopter crash. The specifications for aviation headsets include impact resistance requirements that consumer gear never even considers.
Then the interface?
I'd recommend starting with a commercial USB audio interface that has decent preamps, something like a Focusrite, Scarlett Solo, or a Behringer Euphoria. These give you the balanced inputs and phantom power capability that make interfacing with professional audio much easier. You'll still need to build or buy a bias voltage adapter for the Electromic, but that's a simple circuit.
The PTT integration?
A Raspberry Pi Pico or an Arduino Pro Micro wired to the PTT switch, programmed to present as a USB HID button. There are tutorials for this online. It's a beginner-level microcontroller project.
The barrier to entry is not technical impossibility. It's motivation and patience.
The willingness to spend a few $100s on something that will look very strange to anyone who visits your desk.
Which, for the right person, is a feature, not a bug.
Absolutely a feature. You'll have the only workstation on your block with a NATO standard communications interface.
There's something about this whole conversation that makes me think about the relationship between tools and identity. The prompt is about a very specific technical question, but underneath it is someone saying, I see these environments, I admire the people who work in them, and I want to bring a piece of that ethos into my own workspace.
I think that's legitimate. We spend so much of our lives at our desks. The objects we surround ourselves with shape how we feel about the work we're doing. If having a push-to-talk button that feels like it belongs in an air traffic control tower makes your dictation workflow feel more intentional and professional, that's not nothing.
It's the workstation equivalent of wearing a well-made tool belt, even if you're just doing home repairs. The tool suggests a standard of work.
There's actual research backing this up. The concept of enclosed cognition, the idea that what you wear affects how you perform, extends to tools and environments. People working in spaces that feel professional and intentional tend to produce work that reflects that.
The Herman Poppleberry verdict on the military headset project is technically feasible, economically reasonable for a dedicated hobbyist, and psychologically beneficial.
With the caveat that you should really enjoy the process of figuring it out, because there will be moments of frustration. The pinout won't match the diagram you found. The bias voltage will be wrong on the first attempt. The PTT switch will have a weird to bounce issue.
Standard hobby electronics, then.
The universal experience. But the payoff, a headset and PTT system that will work flawlessly for decades, with audio quality that embarrasses most consumer gear, and a tactile experience that makes you smile every time you key the mic, that's worth it for the right person.
If nothing else, you'll have the most interesting desk in any photo you post online.
Which brings us full circle to the photo book. The prompt started with looking at photos of other people's workstations, and ends with potentially building something that would belong in one of those photos.
There's a nice symmetry there. From admiring the control centers to building a little control center of your own.
That's really what the entire maker and hobbyist tradition is about. Seeing something in a professional context, being drawn to it, and figuring out how to adapt it to your own world.
The democratization of mission-critical ergonomics.
I love that phrase. I'm going to steal it.
You can't steal what's freely given.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, the Faroe Islands had approximately one public clock for every 240 residents, making it one of the most clock-dense rural regions in Europe at the time.
I don't know what to do with that information.
One clock per 240 people, a lot of clocks, for islands in the North Atlantic. So what's the takeaway here? I think it's that the gap between professional and consumer hardware is narrower than it looks if you're willing to do the work to bridge it. The connectors are different. The voltages are different, the impedance is different, but none of it is magic. It's just a different set of design choices optimized for a different set of priorities.
Those priorities, reliability, repairability, tactile clarity, are ones that a lot of us would benefit from even in our non-critical work. The fact that the hardware to achieve them exists and is accessible with some effort is exciting.
It's a reminder that the consumer technology stack isn't the only game in town. There's a whole parallel universe of professional gear that operates on different assumptions and different timescales, and with enough curiosity and soldering, you can bring pieces of it into your own workflow.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and thanks to everyone listening for indulging our enthusiasm for obscure connectors and the people who rely on them.
If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. Until next time.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.